This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jeff Norcott is one of Britain's favourite comedians. He's also one of those rarest of things.
But then something miraculous happens.
A right-wing comedian.
Oh, now you're taking me seriously.
Prior to his career in comedy, he was a teacher. And during his time as a teacher in the 90s and noughties, he encouraged lots of his students to go to university. Now, though, with fees much higher and satisfaction levels at university at an all-time low, he's wondering whether it's really the case that his son should go to university. So he's embarked on a documentary for the BBC saying, is university really worth it? It's a great watch, and Jeff came on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future to chat about what he thinks the future of university and the workplace is.
I'll say something spicy, it might get eyeballs. Let's do it.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, welcome to Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. How do you describe your job?
Driving, mainly, knowing which hotels to go to, which service stations have KFC. The jokes, once you've got them, you've got them. But really, it's about survival.
It's about survival and driving. And hence why you did a documentary on whether you should get a new car or whether Jeff Jr. should go to university. What are your kind of like reflections on that? And what did you study at university?
As you're right, you know, for a comic, what car I drive is an existential question. It's people could say, how relevant is that to a documentary? But these are all these sort of 10,000 mile a year Muppets. I'm doing 35,000. Sorry, Graham, but I do. And it was a big question in the documentary, but it was a way in, you know, I mean, that's the point of it. But it was also a real one. I mean, the truth is I have actually got a new car now. I don't want to spoil the documentary for people, but I lent that way and then I went all the way in. And in terms of what I studied at university, I studied English literature. And it's interesting, you know, because one of the findings of the doc now was that me now, I could fairly say I definitely wouldn't make that decision now. Yeah. Maybe I might still go to university, but I probably wouldn't study that subject.
What do you think you would study if you went?
I don't know. I think that the noise around the higher education sector, I think that the family, particularly my dad was skeptical about me going to university anyway, but you know, when tuition was free and there was still some sort of maintenance grant, there was a level of indulgence which was possible, right? And I loved English. I was good at it. It made sense. I think he would have tried to steer me into something more vocational or just something more impressive sounding that was less about reading books, really.
I was going to say, I think English literature is pretty impressive. And what kind of like reaction have you had to the documentary since then? Like, do you feel there's a bit of a kind of groundswell, a bit of a kickback against the kind of, you know, the whole 50% of people going to university, et cetera, all of that?
I think when the stuff I've done in my career that I've done best is when I've just happened upon something that people were already percolating in their heads. I'm not like a revolutionary or radical thinker. It's just about something an argument that is brewing. And I think that we've had noises coming out of higher education for a while, whether it be through sort of strikes or COVID or grade inflation or, you know, like the amount of people actually doing degrees. All of this stuff has been in the background. People kind of log those things. So the documentary, I hope it was timely. In terms of reaction, I mean, it's been interesting. I've had more people sort of stop me in the street. I mean, that's the old cliche, isn't it? But truthfully, like at service stations, people want to talk to me about the doc. And they want to talk to me generally about their kids or their grandkids and experiences they've had, anxieties they've had about the advice that they've given those grandkids. And, you know, the only real sort of angry response I've had is for people that work in the higher education sector, because naturally, you know, the lecturers, you know, there's a sort of, they have their own grievances with higher education. The students have theirs. So the higher education people probably felt the most attacked. And there was a couple that sort of came for me a little bit online in their own higher education sort of way. But, you know, you got to watch it. I mean, people that smart, you know, you're not just going to get trolled. Probably in about a year, somebody's going to write a thesis on why I'm a dickhead. But, you know, like I totally get the emotional reaction is that if you work in that sector, you want to feel that you're doing a good job for young people. Right? That's a natural human thing. But really, they weren't my concern. They're people that draw a salary from a sector. I was looking at people that effectively, you know, pay those salaries.
Yeah. Do you think doing a documentary like that makes you much more kind of accessible and approachable? I guess like people in service stations, et cetera, might have been like, oh, there goes that kind of comedian previously. Whereas now it's like, oh, no, there's actually something I want to go and talk to him about.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully, one nice thing, and I get this generally, is that people seem to feel like they know me in a really easygoing way. They'll just go, Jed. And then they'll start a conversation as though we've been chatting for years. And I don't know if that's, you know, part of, look, my tour is called Basic Bloke. I mean, I am very much a normal, everyday, someone you see pitched up having I literally just had a Wetherspoons breakfast. So it's, you know, people sort of say, oh, that's the act. I mean, it is the act, but it's also the thing as well. You know, the act often comes from the thing, as long as you keep them close together. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I just think that's interesting because I think it's one of the things about like the act and the same thing, like whether in the modern world, because you've got to be tweeting and doing all this stuff, like it just has to be you. Otherwise, it would be completely exhausting kind of having an act.
Yeah. Yes. No, you're right. I mean, like there was periods when I first started talking about my sort of right of center politics and the fact that I voted leave, there were a number of people that sort of couldn't quite process that combination, because they'd said for years that, well, right-wing people aren't funny. I mean, these are often the same people that were kind of furious when people were saying women can't be funny. I mean, the idea that you could say anybody can't be funny is preposterous anyway. I think it's a bit ridiculous, whether it's women or right-wing people. So what happened was I come along, you know, and I was on MASH Report and stuff. And I think that, you know, I did all right on that show. You could hear me getting laughs from an audience of people who clearly weren't just a kind of rally of Tories, right? So they were challenged and they almost had to come up with what was effectively a conspiracy theory, which is that oh, he's a character act. And I was like, well, yeah, but like with the same name, opinions and dress sense, you know. So all comedians dial up an aspect of their personality. All of them do, right?
Yeah.
A lot of left-wing ones aren't as angry as that in life, right? You know, a lot of right-wing ones aren't as kind of like attack minded. So we're all doing that. But for some reason, when I did it, it was, well, he's being inauthentic. I thought, well, you look at MASH Report, every single person on that was hamming it up a bit because that was the style of the program. It was a satirical take on kind of news and correspondence. So yeah, I you're absolutely right in what you say is that the scale of content that you have to produce now, if you were a fraud on some level, it would be, it would be exhausting.
You just kind of get to find out. Why do you think comedians and just generally kind of creative sector more generally is left wing? I've never quite sort of got why it's so sort of in one direction with that.
Well, I suppose because comedians, essentially, we're terrible people. And I guess that they like to think that there was one side of them that was good, you know, in inverted commas. It's, well, at least I have a sort of like sharing philosophy. I don't know. I suppose, you know, it's an idea of this thing about you've got to punch up, you know, in terms of the status of comedy, you've got to punch up on the establishment. But one of the things I was talking about, you know, when I first started, you know, breaking through in the mid-2010s was, I was sort of saying, well, there are other establishments. It's not just the political establishment, right? You say, well, the government, the Conservative, that's the establishment. There are a number of establishments. You know, the NHS is a powerful establishment. There's the cultural establishment. There's lots of different things that have status that you could kind of take on. And it was this idea sort of took root about punching up, but it was a bit one-dimensional. And I think if you look back at the history of topical humor and satire, they were always various different targets. I always thought that, you know, anywhere that you found, I used to call it the three H's, you know, hyperbole, hypocrisy or hysteria, right? All of those things can be funny. People like, and if you look at, for example, in some of the more militant, look, I mean, when it came to voting Leave, I wasn't like a Brexiteer. I just led that way, right?
Yeah.
But I wasn't ideological about it. If we'd have voted to stay, I probably wouldn't have thought about it much afterwards, to be honest. But the when you looked at the more militant elements of Remain, at times, you know, it was bizarre, like the marches and the chants. And so, I mean, I'm bringing up Brexit now, which is a great way of losing half the people and watching. But, but again, at the extreme ends of anything, there's probably something funny, whether it's at the extreme ends of the Brexiteers who sort of won and then seemed devastated by the fact that they've won because then they didn't know what to be furious about. So yeah, I was always skeptical of the idea that comedy only punched in one direction. It didn't sound much like an art form when you put it like that.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if there is a change of government, whether it changes, but presumably not because most comedians are left-wing through the Labour government as well, generally. I just find it very interesting.
What will happen is when there's a change of government, I mean, and it's already happening, is they'll just say that Labour aren't left-wing enough for them, right? So people that have effectively indirectly argued for a Labour government will get a Labour government and they'll just pivot slightly over to, and what you'll find is left-wing comics and people like me will be saying similar things. The difference is they probably won't want there to not be a Labour government, you know, but that's the point of comedy needing to punch against the establishment. It will just refract slightly and people will have, I suppose what people will have is the luxury once Labour get in and then say, well, I'm Green, you know, or I'm SNP or I'm Plaid or I'm Socialist Worker, or I'm SNP and I don't even live in Scotland. I mean, that's how I foresee it going.
Fair enough. And how do you think comedy will sort of play out this year in election year with topical comedy, et cetera? Like, it's always a pretty hot button issue. But what do you think how will it change?
Well, what was interesting was a few years ago, I can remember when Tim Davies started saying that, you know, there needs to be a little bit more balance in topical comedy. And that was really all he said, was just a bit of balance, maybe one out. If there's a panel of seven people, just maybe one bloke who doesn't hate Churchill and sort of is a bit annoyed by Meghan Markle, you know, that kind of radical shifts. And it was a sort of gauntlet that was laid down to the industry. And then you see what happened ever since then. Well, they've all been cancelled, really. You know, Mock the Week on Channel 4, 8 out of 10 cats, the topical version is gone, MASH Report's gone, the Frankie Boyle Show is gone. So it was an interesting sort of gauntlet that was laid down. And then people ran away from the gauntlet and just said, oh, okay, you win. How about instead of like more balanced topical comedy, how about no topical comedy whatsoever? So what would be interesting this year is that people will go into an election and actually there'll be Have I Got News For You? And there'll be The Last Leg. But there won't be much else besides. I mean, the News Quiz is still going great on Radio 4. It's had a real new lease of life under Andy Zaltzman. But it's kind of, you know, what it was harder for topical shows to get audience as well, in fairness to the TV channels. You know, if you looked at the numbers, they weren't posting great numbers. It became increasingly harder to repeat those shows as the rate of churn in the news cycle became ever more accelerated. So now I think people will just disappear into their own silos more than ever because they'll be getting their topical or discursive content from their favorite podcasts, right? This will be the most atomized. First time I've ever used that word in context. I think I used it right. It'd be the most atomized sort of media consumption that we've ever had going into an election. So hence, you know, like my podcast, what most people think, I've been sort of just naturally pivoting towards it being a more topical kind of comedy podcast because I think that's what I like doing. And actually the places or platforms that there are to do that are much diminished.
What's a good episode for those that haven't checked it out to start with?
Well, the one this week, so I don't know when people watch this, but episode 241 with Mark Nelson is my favorite sort of one where comics, we came up during the club comics sort of period. You know, we sort of cut our teeth here with Rowdy, Stags and Hens. So we always want a punchline with every 30 to, you know, 40 seconds. And he, Mark's a bit left, I'm a bit right, you know, but we both go at the people that we're supposed to defend in a way, which I think is actually where a lot of the British public are now. I think that the tribal thing of the mid to late 2010s is a distant memory, really. And it's just funny. You know, that's what I like. I like talking about politics and public life. But my view is that I only get to make a point if I've got a joke, because otherwise it's just a bloke saying things, you know, like I've got the joke is how I earn the right to spout off.
Yeah. That's a really good way of looking at it. And talk to us about your kind of like transition from teacher to comedian. And what I'm always interested in, the kind of the staging point of like, when did you think, oh, I can really make this work? And sort of, yeah, you know, when were you perhaps first recognized? But those kind of like moments along the way when you thought, like, I can kind of make this transition.
It was just when somebody said that they would be my agent, really. It was an interesting journey for me because I was a teacher, you know, as actually, you know, referring back to the doc, I was part of the Blair drive to get every single living thing to do a degree. You know, I did all that. And then I was enjoying teaching. I didn't hate the job, you know. It's quite unfashionable to say, but it's quite a doable job in some, you know, like if you, it's exhausting. I know teachers will hate me for saying this. They always dig me out. But if it is exhausted, that's the one thing, just the responsibility element and being up on your feet. But if you start a bit earlier in the day and stay behind an hour, you know, just stay on top of your planning, it's a doable job. It's not well paid enough, but it is doable. Yeah. So I kind of enjoyed it. But then I was doing comedy as sort of like, what was it called, a side hustle? That's one of those words that's now the standard thing. I think it used to be moonlighting. Do you remember when people used to call it that? I was doing a bit of moonlighting as a comic. And I was actually like, so some people were doing it as a hobby or trying to get a career. It was actually about money for me, really. It was my sort of mercenary explanation for it. But I was doing the gigs because they're 100 quid here, there, cash was good for me. And, you know, it was necessary for my household. And actually, you know, that weird period of the mid-noughties, just before the credit crunch, when it was the good times were rolling and everyone was getting bigger houses and big mortgages, that was actually my worst financial period. So I was having to do comedy to kind of make sure we weren't going into debt, despite me and my wife both being in work. So, you know, one of the things when I wrote my book, Where Did I Go Right, was how did I end up voting for the Conservatives? Well, in the so-called kind of, you know, good times, they weren't as good for me. And I remember when the credit crunch hit and they sort of said like, oh, the party's over. And I was like, well, what party? Just suddenly finding out there was a party had finished that I evidently hadn't been invited to.
That's pretty brutal though, like both working and sort of still struggling, right? Like, that must have been tough.
Yeah, I don't know how we managed it, I suppose, because I suppose interest rates were, I mean, they've got back up to near that level, but interest rates were a lot higher. There was a lot of stealth taxes at that time. You know, national insurance had crept up. I remember council tax was the big one. I mean, that was just going up in leaps and bounds. And yeah, we didn't have a particularly flashy life. Yeah. So, you know, an agent sort of come along and was gigging. He said, oh, do you know you could do this for a living? And I sort of thought, all right, you know, one, there was a lot of appeal to the fact that I could just get my hair cut on a Tuesday, you know, when everyone else was at work, you know, get up late and stuff. But I also thought, you know, if I do comedy more and I can still supply teach Monday to Wednesday, we'll be in a better financial position. So the irony was, and I talk about this in the book, is that when the credit crunch hit, mortgages went down, petrol went down, I was teaching, supplying and doing comedy. It was the first time I'd had any spare money. So it's a very odd thing was that during the greatest recession in our lifetime, it was the first time I'd had any spare change.
Yeah. But it's an interesting way of like flexing it, right? In terms of doing Monday to Wednesday and so on. That'd be fun. Why do you think quite a lot of comics start out as teachers? Because there's Ramesh Ranganathan as well. It's quite a kind of common sort of
Frank Skinner, path.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
It's a really boring answer. There's just a lot of teachers. Like, if you look at the sheer numbers game, there are several hundred thousand teachers, I think. So there's just a lot of them. So the stats are, so naturally there'll be a lot in comedy. It's a similar story, I think, with doctors as well. You know, Paul Sinner, Simon Brodkin as well, Harry Hill. There's been quite a few doctors. So if a job has, you know, a lot of people employed in that sector, comedy tends to reflect real life in a, to an extent. I think there's probably a slight overrepresentation because there's a Venn diagram between the skill set of standing up in front of a group of people, sort of winning their trust and kind of controlling a room. So there's a slight reason. And maybe with doctors, there's bedside manner. I think that is it, to be honest. That's the boring truth.
What's your advice for young comics trying to get into it now?
I got no idea. I mean, that's a terrible answer, but it's become so atomized. Mm-hmm. Antimorist? Yeah. I don't know. D-Ray. But yeah, but with social media, you find your own path now. That if you'd have asked me 10 years ago, I would be very clear cut. It would have been do open spots, get a 10 together, then get a 20 together, try and earn a living from the circuit, go and do an Edinburgh, make sure you land big, get some TV people along. None of that stuff is guaranteed or to work. Even then, back then, the odds of that being effective were slim. Now, I would just say, what do you think is funny? Like, what do you exactly think is funny? Be as precise as you can and then try and take that to market on social media in some way and see if anybody else feels the same way too. The one thing that I worry about with comics is that what social media tends to like is I always thought comedy there was an element of being an all-rounder. I like doing a bit of observation, right? A bit of politics, a bit of topical. You know, every tour I do is roughly between those three things. But social media, you've probably seen yourself with the clip culture. You know, it's become quite a big part of comedy. A lot of it is like, if you're the person that says, Gen Z do this, but boomers do this, or dogs be like this, but cats be like this. It's fine. You can get like a big following quickly, but I do wonder if there's a shelf life to that. You know, I don't know if you're going to carry that audience all the way. What one thing about a joke is that if it's the same joke, ultimately people crack the code. So, you know, and even now what you see with younger comics, there's some that have done really well and built up hundreds of thousands of followers on certain platforms. But who are those followers? Do they have disposable income? Are they the kind of people that go to comedy clubs? You know, that my social media numbers are okay, but what I can sell on tour is in disproportion to what I've got social media. If you looked at if you just took my Instagram numbers, for example, you wouldn't think I could do a tour where I could sort of sell 600-700 seaters. But I think I'm playing to a slightly older audience, not always, but
yeah.
But the brutal truth is, they're the ones that can spend money. They're the ones that have got disposable income. It's not why I did it, but you know, I'm not displeased that that's how it ended up.
Yeah. And how do the economics of comedy break down in terms of like, where do you find sort of like, you know, where is it in terms of making money? Because it's interesting for musicians, right? Mm. Like that's got a lot more now about like not really, you know, it's actually not the sort of releasing the music that's making the money. It's the shows and tours, etc. How is that changing in comedy?
It's all about the live really now, you know, but the problem is the threshold at which you can earn a proper amount of money for that is relatively high for what it takes to get to that point. You know, I'm at the point now on this tour, I'd sort of say, it'd be hard to describe, but an upper medium level touring act, maybe something like that. You know, I always think of it like football. You know, you've got like, you know, your Manchester City, Arsenal, Liverpool, that's going to be like your McIntyres, you know, your kind of Ranganathans, people like that. Then you've got the people in the Champions League slots, you know, I won't name them now because no one will comment to like, they'll then feel slighted, but there'll be just a level below that. But I'm kind of like, you know, once a season, I'll challenge for the UEFA conference or whatever. But just getting to that level is like the consequence of 20 years work, right? The economics of it are that you need to have other stuff. I mean, I still write for a number of television shows, you know, and I enjoy that. I've done that for 15 years. I love doing that. Corporate gigs, another one. But again, look, the thing is with corporates, right? And this is might be a contested thing to say is, but the kind of comedy that works at a corporate gig is still what some people would call quite not old fashioned, but when I say old fashioned, I mean 10 years ago, old fashioned.
Yeah. You
know, it has to have setups, punchlines, really old fashioned, out of fashion, off trend stuff in comedy. So, you know, if comics come through now and they cultivate a very niche audience, that can be brilliant. You know, like people who really love them and will consume anything they produce. But if you go out of corporate and do something whimsical, you're going to get found out.
Yeah. That's interesting though. Yeah. Really interesting. So what shows do you write for?
I try not to go on about the stuff I write for too much, because the problem is with the public is if you say I write for that show, the public for some reason then lurch to, oh, well, that person doesn't write any of their own stuff then. Like they just literally go from naught to 1,000 miles an hour. And the reason that I say that is there's been things I've written where I've had like a writing team as well. So equally, it's kind of like a code is that they wouldn't go on social media going, oh, one of my jokes.
Okay.
Because that's not actually how it works. Because what happens is you have the talent, as they call it, and they're always smart people. And the truth is, the overwhelming majority of stuff they say or do will be stuff that comes from them. What you're there to do is bounce off, take an idea, help them flesh it out. Sometimes, yeah, you'll just come up with a line that slots straight in. So it just seems a bit grabby to take a bit of, you know, the credit when you go, well, that person, not only did they have to decide what jokes there were, rewrite them, they then had to stand up, say them, get the laugh. So, you know, the whole pyramid of the creative thing, you're very much like at the ground level. So it's not always the case. You know, some writers sort of seem happy to let you know what they've done. But I mean, they're on my credits if people want to go and have a look. But,
fair enough. If people want to find out, they can.
Sorry, I seem like I was being evasive there. But it's humble or noble. But it's not, I guess part of it is just that I was sort of thinking, well, if somebody who helped me write like for a Radio 4 series was suddenly going out, well, the thing was, I said to Jet, you know, what do you want there, mate? You know, like oh, I wouldn't necessarily appreciate that either. So that's how I tend to play.
No, that's fair. But let me delve into the kind of like creative process of a writing room and stuff, because I'd be really interested to learn about that. It's one of these things, right? Because people think they you know, it kind of sounds a bit classic, but they can only be what they can see, right? So sometimes they think, like, if I want to be in comedy, I've got to be a comedian. And actually, there's quite a lot of jobs that are sort of behind that. So it'd be quite interesting to talk us through that kind of like writer's room type thing, how it works and operates.
So there are sort of two ways of becoming a TV writer, one of which is that it's you're just a comic who becomes big sort of trusts your mates. And you kind of bring them in with you. So you come in with the talent. Then there's another way whereby you've sort of come through the route of working for a production company. You might have been a runner, assistant producer. Obviously, they come to you for ideas. You might have funny ideas. You sit in a room sometimes as a scribe. So if there's like four writers there, there'll be somebody whose job is to kind of chronicle the ideas that are coming out. And sometimes those people must have the weirdest day, just a group of predominantly, I'll be honest, middle-aged men who, although it's changing, just moaning about their wives for the best part of a day and getting the odd joke in there. And then, you know, you might throw a line out and bit by bit, you go, you know what, you're actually right. Do you want to do like half a day's writing on this and build it up like that? So the way it would work is a lot of people sort of ask questions. I suppose if I could address the FAQs, maybe that would be helpful. He's like, is it per gag? It's not, you know, because the mechanics of whether or not a good gag gets in and gets in the edit. It's so much like most TV shows over record. So it wouldn't be on that. It's about time. You know, it's about a day's writing and you're expected to produce a volume. I mean, if I'm writing for a show for a day, I'd probably aim for between 6 to 8 sides of A4, which, you know, sounds like a lot, but the creative process, it like, you know, to give you a clue, if 5 of those jokes ended up in the final edit of a show, that wouldn't be a bad return at all, really, you know, because there'll be other writers. It all get condensed down. Then there's the record. Something might get a laugh in the record, but it doesn't make sense in the edit. You know, a lot of shows record for 3 hours for a half hour show. So you just sit there, you know, some people are slow to get going. I probably like break union rules because I just want to crack on. Like the moment I sit down, I'm like, let's write some jokes. I'm like a cricketer that likes being in the nets, you know?
Yeah.
I want to feel bat on ball. And just start writing jokes, you know, they start getting through it. And then, you know, you have these kind of like periods in the day where the sweet spot creatively does seem to be, I would say, from about 10:30 till about 12:15. There's something about that. And I think that's true in a lot of jobs. I often say if I haven't written anything then I'm probably going to struggle because that is, and if I get any distractions during that time, if I'm writing at home, I get quite defensive of my time because I know that trying to write stuff once I've got a cheese roll inside me is a slightly different proposition.
I see. It's really interesting, actually. I remember I used to say at number 10 that, I mean, we started early, unsurprisingly, but like I'd basically know whether we won or lost the day by 10:30. Like it would either have just got away from us already. And like, yeah, but it is interesting how most jobs are kind of like jobs in the morning in some ways.
Well, I mean, that's all relative. You guys would have been going first from first thing, but in TV, people just start at 10 because it's TV, darling.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically,
I mean, I would happily start at 9. You know, I'm quite an early bird, but these guys, they want to slope in, you know what I mean, with their kind of gluten-free. Oh, here I go. He's doing the cliche jokes about what they eat. I can't help it. I can't. Gluten-free croissants. Is there such a thing? I hope not.
I'm sure there is, Liz Linton. Let's do some kind of like quick fires. What do you think you'd study at university today?
Maybe law.
Yeah. Why?
Because I watched A Few Good Men and when I was like 15 and when he said, you can't handle the truth, I thought, yeah, I'd like to do that. I mean, it's the same way a lot of people get into politics because I guess they see that famous backbencher speech, but that is the absolute kind of tip of the iceberg of all of the job entails. But it was the one professional qualification other than teaching that I considered. But the truth is, I mean, so you asked me what I might have studied. It's the truth that I might have studied law. But it's also the truth that I would have been terrible and would probably have flunked it within about a year because I would have realized that how much work is involved in it.
Yeah. What's your dream car?
It's the car I've got now since the documentary. It's a Renault Clio hybrid. I love it because it's the last thing in the world that I would spend big money on. But if I feel like I've got a deal, maybe this is why I like Travelodges, or if I've got a thing that is functional for a decent price, I'm quite happy. So this Renault, mate, it's amazing. I've got DAB radio. That's a first for me. I'm living the dream. I'm genuinely quite happy with quite modest things, really.
You really are living up to it. And what, hey, throw me off. Oh, what would be your dream cabinet job?
Cabinet job. I think foreign secretary is the sexy one, isn't it? I mean, that's why Cameron came back. He's not coming back for a home office. That's a nightmare, isn't it? Or housing or any of the ones that have a rate of churn of about 1 a week. Foreign secretaries tend to do it for a while. You know, James Cleverly was an exception, but it was an obvious piece of sort of shuffling the chessboard. But they tend to do it for a while. And it's got, I don't know, there's a grandiosity about it. You seem to be separate. I mean, Cameron, you know, has obviously got the thing that he's not actually an MP at the moment, but he seems to be separate from all the bullshit somehow. I mean, Hague had a great time, didn't he, as foreign secretary. I mean, he was like, you could just design who'd be a great foreign secretary. Because what you want, actually, I think, for a foreign secretary, he's somebody who the rest of the world goes, this is what an Englishman is, you know, or this is what an Englishwoman should be. Is that they, you know, they talk in a very, you know, sort of clipped and resonant way and stuff. I would just supply it. I would just have somebody out of Downton do the job. I'd get an actor from Downton. Because that's what they want. That's what they want on the international stage.
That's great. And which politicians do you think would have the best comedy set in them? Because they've got to be, for quite a lot of politicians are funny, right? Like it's a way of communicating, etc. But who do you think would have the best set in them?
Well, I think it's funny because we spoke earlier about people saying that right-wingers can't be funny. But actually, if you look at, you know, politics, a lot of the sort of right-wing politicians have to be funny because it's a defense mechanism against being perceived to be the bad guy, right? They sort of have to have a sense of irony. I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg can be quite droll. I mean, before he actually became part of the central machine of it, when he was a backbencher, he had this authenticity, you know, and a lot of young people identified with him because that's the kind of thing that they crave. So I think that he could be quite funny. Cameron was actually pretty good at the dispatch box, I think. I think that's kind of been forgotten. You know, he could get laughs. I mean, the current two, Sunak and Starmer, are among the worst I think I've seen. Theresa May, you're sort of like, well, no one's expecting her to get laughs, but these two, it's like, you know, they think, oh, I should be able to do this, and neither of them can. I mean, Stephen Flynn, actually, you know, he's pretty good operator just with language. There was a question that he asked, yesterday as we're talking about, you know, which of the current front and shadow benches is set to inherit the sort of Thatcherite mantle and stuff. But it's just the way he asked it. It was nice and sarky. And got a laugh. So, yeah, maybe Jacob Rees-Mogg or Stephen Flynn.
All right, they're interesting ones. Which comedians inspired you on the way up?
Well, for me, it was like, you know, the Ross Abbott, which is going to sound flippant, but he made me laugh. I used to watch the Ross Abbott show and I just thought he was a funny guy. And you know, Basildon Bond was hilarious at the time. Now, in a world where we since had spy spoofs and Austin Powers, but I maintain that there would be no Austin Powers without Basildon Bond. He was hilarious. You know, I don't know if See You, Jimmy is culturally sensitive anymore, but he was hilarious. And he just seemed like a nice guy. And you know, the truth was, I actually met him because he was my hero. My mum somehow arranged for me to go and meet him backstage when he was playing in the West End. Luckily, it's a story from the 80s where a small kid met a famous man and nothing bad happened. But he was top bloke, like you could just tell, just a nice man, like a really nice man. And also Dave Allen, I remember my mum used to watch him and I thought he was just so classy and you know, he would do stuff about religion and satirical stuff. And I guess maybe I was sort of a bit inspired by that to think you could go from talking about a big subject to talking about, you know, how men stand in front of the fridge and just stare into it like it's a void, you know, like he could pivot nicely between those things. And then as I grew up, you know, Eddie Murphy was a big guy for a lot of people my age, Richard Pryor as you got a bit older. And then, you know, probably a lot of Americans, really, you know, Bill Burr, Louis C.K. with the caveat, obviously. There's not an endorsement of what he did, but a brilliant comic. And then some circuit legends in the UK, really, like people like, he was a friend of mine, Ian Stone, brilliant comic. Yeah. Just rocking a room. Jeff Innocent, you know, who's now doing great things on Instagram. Tom Stade, a Canadian comic who I'd recommend anybody, if you want to see a genuinely edgy comic at the fringe, you know. I guess a lot of them had bravado and a bit of swagger, I guess, you know, the longer I went on. So the idea that you could just go out there and just strut a little bit. I mean, obviously, when you're British, there's a limit, but I used to love seeing the American comics do that.
Have you done many international gigs?
Yeah, but I always hesitate as to say international. What it often means is I did some gigs in front of some British people in a different part of the world. the truly international ones I've done recently were shows for the Comedy Store, and they were in Denmark. And these audiences are incredible. Like, it's not just that they speak English, it's just they get all of it. I barely had to moderate anything, even topical references. So that was incredible in Denmark. In France, there was about 70% of the audience could speak, understand the humor. I think 30% were partners that had been dragged along because their partner was an Anglophile sort of thing. So I did lots of facial expressions and that seemed to keep them happy. Norway, obviously the Scandinavian countries. It's easy to say, oh, it's humbling that the way they speak English so well, but English is just a global language, you know. It's just, it's not our fault that it's taken off in the way that it has.
What's your favorite theatre to play in?
Reagan Theatre, I mean, in terms of just having great gigs, the Leicester Square Theatre is hard to beat. There's just, everyone's right in front of you. It's 400 people, but it feels both more and less, if you know what I mean. In terms of proximity, it feels less, but in terms of reaction, it feels like more. And I suppose there's something quite sexy as a comic about you're in the heart of London's West End on a weekend. You know, it feels pretty cool just kind of like barging your way through Leicester Square for all the tourists thinking, like, I'm doing a show here tonight.
Yeah. Have you got examples of jokes that work really well that you didn't think would work well at first and vice versa?
I think there'd just be too many to mention. That is basically the standard genesis of a joke, is that you have an idea and then what often happen is along the way to what you think is the punchline, you'll stumble over what really is the punchline to the audience. And then, so you get a big laugh, then you'll do what you thought was punchline, gets a small laugh. And then here is the absolute complicated art of it. You switch them around the following night. And the old, if you want like a bona fide bit of advice, it's such a simple one, but people have worked in this game years often forget it, is put the funny bit at the end. The funniest word, idea, bit, put it at the end. And it's so easy to forget that because, you know, that's why it's a punchline. It should be the last thing that people hear. But yeah, you just don't know what's funny as an idea quite often. And this is not a sad truth, but for a lot of comics, the stuff you absolutely think is the funniest, you'll find hard to make it work.
Fair enough. Well, that is a great way to finish. Give us the plugs for everything then, the documentary, the book, podcast, etc. Just go for all the names, etc.
Yeah, so the podcast is What Most People Think. So it's a weekly topical comedy podcast. There's two books, really. I think both books could be of interest. There's A British Bloke Decoded, which is the most recent one. That's more of a funny book, but there's some sort of social discourse on the state of British men. And then Where Did I Go Right, which is about how I ended, you know, grew up on a council estate, you know, dad, both parents were disabled, but I ended up voting Tory. So it's kind of me trying to work out how that happened. And then the tour, Basic Bloke, which is out to the end of April. And then I'm at the Edinburgh Fringe for a 5-night run, Final Chance to See. And, or Final Chance for Me to rid some more money out of it, whichever way you want to look at it. And then the documentary. I mean, I'd really love it if people would watch it, because the feedback I've got from it, from meeting people on social media and even, you know, in terms of press, it's been the best for anything I've ever had. As a subject, it's not sexy. So, you know, I get it. It's like, if you're looking through the iPlayer and stuff, you go, the one about murder, one about paedophiles, or the one about university. But if you want something that is, I don't know if there is one about paedophiles, but that's generally where documentaries seem to land these days. But if you want something that's just informative and starts a discussion, we've done it in a way that I think tonally we really got it right. And it is, there's funny, there's genuinely like moments in there that I stand by as a hope that will make people laugh.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. We really enjoyed it. Where, how did the idea come about? Like, how does that sort of happen?
Well, I guess I'm doing stuff for the BBC and I kind of had this, you know, I sort of look at those opinions I have that I think are slightly, very mildly subversive, but that might be able worth exploring. And then, you know, I had a chat, you know, BBC Current Affairs sort of interested in me. You have chats about a number of things. And I just said, look, I'm not sure going to university is as much of a slam dunk idea as it used to be. Now, obviously in the realms of TV and the creative arts and BBC, that in itself is a like, whoa, fucking handbrake turn moment. And, you know, like, and I think the great thing is like, what you get, you know, the BBC, and this is where people just get annoyed with me because they think I'm a shill, but there are a lot of smart people there, you know, that will play against type. So almost everybody I developed this show with went to university, probably likes university, you know, it's on that side of the fence. But I made an argument and they thought it was an interesting thing to explore further, you know, in the same way that I did a documentary about, you know, how the middle classes were in Britain. I was essentially pitched to the people that the documentary is about. So you know, there are these incredible people in the BBC that are sort of self-flagellating, you know, and you know, the Commissioner Joe and Mike Radford that helped me make it. You know, they're just really smart people, and they've got this desire as well, which is to have documentaries that might appeal more to a working class audience. You know, if they see somebody who looks and sounds like me, you know, they might do better. I'm not saying that audience don't watch documentaries, but they might do better in that thing. So we're waiting for all the iPlayer stats and everything to come in, and I'll find out how it did.
Well, it would be really interesting. And right, you had a Weatherspoons breakfast. What are you having for lunch?
Co-op meal deal. The travel lodge I'm at, there's a co-op over the way. So I've sort of spoiled myself a little bit with the Weatherspoons. So I'll pull it back financially and bring it in all the per diems. That'll still be under a tenner, I think. That gets me to lunch. That's doing all right.
Yeah. Brilliant. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future.
Nice one, Jimmy. Thanks, mate.